National Fishermen and Pacific Marine Expo are proud supporters of the Galley Stories podcast, as we make similar efforts to highlight the people and topics that define commercial fishing. You can see what that looks like in print and online all year long, as well as every November in Seattle when this community comes together at PME. Check out nationalfisherman.com and pacificmarineexpo.com to learn more.
Big news here at Galley Stories, guys. We have a sponsor, Alaskan Brewing Company out of Juneau, Alaska. These guys have been crafting amazing beers since 1986. First ones were all hand-packed, and all of them are either flown out or taken by sea. No roads. And of course, that's where our connection comes in. At Galley Stories, we're all about history and connections, and these guys have done it by staying in their community. I know that many of you have seen Alaskan Brewing Company's products in stores or at your local watering hole. Alaskan Brewing Company, the official beer of Galley Stories.
Hello, and welcome to Galley Stories, stories of the Bering Sea and beyond, hosted by Mark Kaler. My name is Penka Jane, podcast deckhand and longtime listener. We'd thank you to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a review. Here's today's catch.
Hello, guys. Welcome to another installment of Galley Stories, stories of the Bering Sea and beyond. I'm your host, Mark Kaler. Today we have captain and vessel owner, Louis Lohenberg. How are you doing today, Louis?
Pretty good. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. So let's just jump into it. What was your start in commercial fishing?
My start in commercial fishing was, I was raised in a town in Depot Bay, Oregon, a small town of 200 people. Started out working in a fish cannery, and by the age of about 17, I bought my first boat. It was a salmon troller, and started out there. I graduated from high school in 1968, and I was supporting two brothers and a sister, and tried college and couldn't hack it financially, so I went back fishing. The next year I went to Alaska. It was 1969, and went there in April, came home in October, and I had $24,000 in my pocket. A lot of money back then. Fished the winter in Oregon, went back to Alaska the next summer. The rest was history. We found out there was plenty of things to fish. You could work as hard as you wanted to. And in our small town, we worked, but we didn't make any money. There you could make a lot of money. So I spent the next year working on deck, and I got to looking around and thinking, I can do as well as those guys. I'd gone up with a guy named Chuck Thompson, and then he was bought out by a gentleman, Ted Painter. We called him Old Feller, and he was from Depot Bay. He had two sons, and so I talked him into letting me run one of his boats. It was a Uyak. It was a 62-foot wooden boat. So we took off for Alaska. I had two crewmen, both of them, one guy was 43 and the other guy was 24. I was barely 20. That was a little bit of an experience. Got there, it was April, pretty bad weather in Kodiak. And so we decided to go tanner fishing. Never even seen a tanner crab. We were Dungeness fishermen. So we rigged up some gear and we went fishing. Well, we starved to death. We could hardly wait for Dungeness season to start. So we went out and we had a real good season Dungeness fishing, and king crab came around, and I talked a guy into giving me 12 king crab pots. And we went king crabbing. We made some decent money that winter. And
this is all on that wooden boat?
All on a wooden boat. Yeah, all on a wooden boat. I did that for, I ran that boat for almost 2 years. Got a chance to get a steel boat, and it was a little bit bigger. So I got it, charged straight for the Bering Sea. Never been there in my life. Got out there and we were fishing king crab then, and back then we didn't have much for navigation. We had radar, but we couldn't, you know, you didn't see much. And we had these old APN Lorans from World War II, which weren't real accurate. Most everything was with dead reckoning. You'd find a point of land and sail out time and distance and look for your gear. And some days you'd look for hours. And everybody talked to each other because we tried to help each other find each other's gear. It was pretty primitive. And we delivered a floating processor back in those days into Port Moeller. And the boat was kind of a wreck. Did everything we could to keep it together. Finally, after the season, we just gave up and went back to Kodiak. And I jumped aboard another boat, working on deck.
Now, that boat, did you buy that boat, the steel one?
I had an option to buy it, but we chose not
which,
to buy
which
it.
Vessel was that one?
That was a Karika. Hmm. And so I went back to work on deck, and then old feller, who was a mentor for a lot of guys in the industry, he and a guy named Wilburn Hall, which I had an opportunity to work for both, they put a lot of guys in business, a lot of guys. Just from Lincoln County alone, there was probably 100 guys came up there. From our little town of Depot Bay, there was over 20 of us that went up. You know, one of us would go and we'd hear these stories and fame and fortune, and somebody would follow us. My brother followed me and my sister, and it was just a great land opportunity. Fishing was open basically year round. You could fish as much as you wanted. So I worked on deck for a couple of years, and back in the shrimp days, and then had an opportunity. Old feller, he went in partners with me on another boat, the Midnight Sun, and took it fishing, and I paid for my share of it in about a year and a half. And
what size boat was that?
That was a 75 footer. And then in the late 70s, Farm Credit was financing anybody and everybody, and Bender was building boats in the South. And a lot of us signed up to buy boats. So borrowed $1.5 million and built a boat, and my brother and I built another boat, and off to the north we went. Well, the boats were late, and the season kind of took a little dive at that moment, so we struggled a little bit and got back on track. And from there, I bought a couple, four more boats. And in those days, like I say, we fished year-round. One year I was home less than 30 days, much to the chagrin of my family. Excuse me. But times were good. Everybody looked out for each other. We were kind of we all came from, or not all of us, but a number of us came from the same part of the country. So we didn't have family there, so everybody became your extended family. And of course, coming from the same area, a lot of us knew each other. We were highly competitive. We kind of thrived off of each other. We looked after each other. We all prospered. Great opportunity.
What was that first boat you built?
First boat I built was the Arctic Lady.
Okay.
And
so while we're talking about the Arctic Lady, when I interviewed Chad, it came up in the comment sections about the gal on the boat, the painting, the mural. So can you tell us the story on that?
Well, when I built the boat, we struggled and struggled for a name, and of course, a lot of guys were naming them after their daughters or their wives, and I wanted something different, so I chose the Arctic Lady. And then I was talking to the crew one day, and we were talking about some guys had different things on the flying bridge, and they said, let's put a gal on there. And I said, fine by me. You guys figure it out. So they got out all their magazines, and they looked them all over, and they picked out a gal from one of the Playboy magazines, and she went up on the bridge.
She's still up there.
Well, it's not the same version one. Of her. Over the years, we've had a number of them. They get tired of looking at the same one, and about every trip to the shipyards, about every 3 years, they change her out. And we got to the one that we have on there now, and she's had a good run. She's been there probably 9 or 12 years, something like that. About due to change out again. It's been a controversial thing. We were coming out of Lake Union one time, and there was a bunch of Girl Scouts on a little tour boat, and they started pointing at us, and the boat immediately turned and went the other way. And then in the old days, when we go into the pot dock at Dutch, Betty, she was the gal that ran it there, she'd make us cover her with a tarp. So, but she'd been there a long time.
Cover that thing up where you go there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, but I ran the boat for 4 or 5 years, and then I turned it over to a fellow named Kevin Campbell, who ran it for, I guess he's ran it for, probably, he probably ran it 40 years before he quit. He came on, he was 20 years old too. But we've fished everywhere in Alaska there is to go, except southeast. Fished clear out to Attu, fished Adak, was out there when we single pot fished brown crab. Fished Tanners in both the Bering Sea and Kodiak. We took Opie's to Kodiak in 1975. Alaska Packers wanted some Opie's, and we were fishing Bairdi up between the islands. And in those days, every foreign country was allowed to fish in our waters. That's for the 200-mile limit. And it was like fishing on a golf course. The Japanese were in there with their little conical pots, and they just canvas an area. And we were trying to fish in there with them. And we were fishing Bairdi, and when we get into the Opie's, our pots would come up, and they'd just be a ball. So we called APA and Kodiak and asked them if they'd like some, and they said, oh, bring us a load in. So we took a load in. We got 8 cents for them in 1975. Along with the load of Opie's, we took a deck load of glass floats.
The Japanese glass floats.
Japanese glass floats. We decided that they shouldn't be in our waters, so we just went along and clipped their floats and threw them on the deck and took them back home. But those were tough times in those days. Fishing around the foreigners, the trawlers were in there when we were fishing in Kodiak in the Straits. They would be trawling right alongside of us, and then. Then the 200-mile limit came into effect, and they went away, but not very willingly. They would sneak back and forth in, and that was before the days of being able to track boats. Nowadays, you can't get away with anything. So, but we fished a little bit of everywhere. We went to Nome. We went. We fished up on the Russian line in the 80s, fished Opie's clear up in there, and then we fished, like I say, golden crab or brown crab. Done a lot of stuff. Back then, we could fish 12 months a year. Today, as you know, rationalization came in 17 years or 18 years ago, and it curtailed our fishing somewhat. It was a good thing and a bad thing. We all fought it. We didn't want to be restricted at all at the time. We were pretty much cowboys and thought we ought to be able to do anything anytime we wanted to.
Beat the guy next to you.
Yeah. So it was quite a change. Our first rationalization was halibut, and we did fish halibut. And then when we didn't have a halibut was a little bit different. When crab came in, it was a lot different. We formed co-ops, and we had to deliver to a certain processor. We had to be matched up, that type of thing. And at that point, we all formed our co-ops. And then a year into it, I decided that it wasn't working quite the way everybody thought it ought to. And myself and the five other guys decided to form a big co-op of co-ops, which was ICE. And we formed ICE, and in conjunction with the canneries, we improved the program. That was 17 or 18 years ago that we did that. I served as president for 16 of those years. And along with that, we decided to, another five guys and I decided to form a research foundation. And so we, we formed a Bering Sea Fisheries Research Foundation, and we got the processors to help fund it with us. And we struggled for the first 5 years. We had guys coming and going and processors that some did, some didn't. But subsequently, it's been around about the same amount of time, 16, 17 years, very successful. We are now doing a lot of research with NOAA and NIMS, the state of Alaska. It's been a good thing for everybody.
What type of research?
We've been doing gear research. We do trawl surveys. We do commercial gear versus the gear that they use typically. We use their gear. We've done a little bit of everything. We're just starting on a new wintertime surveys, pot surveys, which they have done very little of, to try to compare them. One of the troubles with research is it doesn't happen overnight, and then they have to have a database to compare things against. So your first 4 or 5 years when you start anything, you don't get many results.
You're just getting the groundwork.
You're just getting the groundwork.
The baseline.
Yeah, it's pretty frustrating for fishermen because they're used to seeing instant results. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't work, they want to change and do something else.
Right, real quick.
Real quick, you know. Yep. You know exactly what I'm talking about. So it's been a challenge. It's been good for everybody. I've worked hard at fishing. I've worked hard with giving back to the industry. It's been good to my family and my myself. I have two sons engaged in it and one daughter. I have a grandson that's wants to be a fisherman. He goes to Bristol Bay. We fish in Bristol Bay also, and he started when he was about 8, and of course he wants to spend his money on motorcycles and that type of stuff.
I was going to ask you what is the sea giving you? I guess it's...
Well, it's giving me a hell of a good life, I can tell you that. Where I grew up, we were very poor. We lived basically on subsistence part of the year. My mom cooked on a wood stove. Like I say, when I got to Kodiak, all you had to do was work hard, and we were used to that. But it's given us a good life, been able to do a lot of things other people aren't able to do. I diversified early. I had been in commercial real estate from a young age, so I diversified into that. I just thought that the sun wasn't going to shine forever, and right now it isn't shining for us. It's very dim.
There's a storm out there.
Yeah, it's a pretty big storm. But we'll all survive one way or another, or some of us will survive for sure. I don't know what the future holds, but the sea is a great source of protein. We're always going to turn to it. I think, the management of the fisheries has changed over the years. And, of course, we have different user groups, and we're always competing against each other, and there's better and better science all the time. And hopefully it'll balance out here. The scientists will get better at managing the resource, predicting it. It's a hard thing to predict. We have very little control of the fisheries, as you know. And the economics of it, we have almost no control, because seafood has become a global commodity, and we have other nations that they can produce it cheaper than we can. Right now, we're at a real disadvantage, because some of the countries are trying to produce cash, and they're selling the product at less than what we can produce it for. So that's put us in a real tailspin. What the future holds, I don't think anybody knows.
Right. Yeah. What is the sea taking away from you?
Well, it took a lot of years away from my family. Like I say, I was gone a lot. They endured it. It was hard on us physically. I'm in the middle of having two knee operations. They didn't stand up real well over the years. Of course, I badly mistreated them. I never thought I'd get to be this age, so you're invincible when you're young. Mm-hmm. Paying the price now. I got to tell you that for the most part, you don't remember the tough times. You only remember the good times. You speak of the bad weather and the storms as an adventure. I don't think any of us that have done it didn't love it. But it did take its toll. I mean, there's lots of lonely days and nights, and lots of times when you're sick or hurt and you can't run to the doctor. You can't go in and take a couple of days off. Other guys are dependent upon you. So you just endure. But it definitely takes a toll on your family. It takes a toll on you physically. But the rewards, they're tremendous. I was very lucky. I got to do a job all my life that I loved. It wasn't a job. It was an opportunity to go do something every day that I liked.
So. What was your best day at sea? Do you remember the best experience at sea that you've had?
Probably my best day at sea that I remember the most is when my son Chad was born. He was born on November 16th, and it was next to the last day of Kodiak king crab season, and I deck-loaded the boat with king crab, and we were getting $1.10 a pound. And it was well over $100,000 a day, and it was the biggest trip I'd ever had, and it was the day my youngest son was born. So it's probably the day I remember the most. One of my worst days at sea was when my youngest daughter was born. We were in ADAC fishing. It was Christmas time. We'd gone into Kiska, had a big dinner, and went back out fishing, and it was blowing. It was tough. Ended up blowing over 100 miles an hour. We went back out on Christmas Eve in the morning, and it started blowing, and it was blowing over 100 knots. And Christmas Day came, and we up behind Semisopotnoy, and Christmas evening, Peggy Dyson, the weather lady, gave me a call and said, "You're about to have your wife's about to have a baby." And then, so I said, "Okay." And so December 26th, she called me and said, "You need to go to ADAC." And I said, "I need to go to ADAC." "Yeah, your wife and daughter have been evacuated to Anchorage." So I headed for ADAC, and my brother chartered an airplane to come into ADAC to pick me up. And we got there, and there was guards there, and they took me up to the commanding officer, and he he sat me down. He said, son, I got to tell you, your wife and daughter are in the hospital, and you got a plane coming to pick you up. He says, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to send you back to the hangar, and you'll have to wait there for the plane. And they sent me back to this hangar. They brought me a cup of coffee and a donut. I sat there for 6 hours waiting for the plane. And it came, took me back to Anchorage, and everything turned out well. My daughter is now 40 years old, and everything's good. So that's the life of a fisherman. You either have good days or you have bad days. There's not many average days.
Yeah. So. Obviously, you're still here, but did you any significant close calls?
Oh, yeah, you have lots of those. Yeah, the UYAK, the first boat, I was traveling with Ted Painter's son, Ted, and he had a steel boat, 72-footer, called the Irene H, and we got to Yakutat, and it was blowing, and we went in and anchored, and the weather came down a little, and Ted said, well, let's get out of here. And I said, okay. And he said, let's just cut straight across. It'll be quicker. Well, when you're that age, you're invincible. What the hell? So we started across. Well, we encountered some pretty tough weather. And I was carrying Dungeness pots, and some of those shifted, so we had to cut some of them loose. Then we got closer to Kodiak and started icing up. All things we'd never encountered. I'd never encountered. Hell, I'd never run a crab boat. So it was a pretty tense day. We got into Kodiak, and thankful that we'd made it. Had several times when had one boat catch on fire. Fire is probably the scariest thing of everything because when the boat's sinking, you're too busy trying to keep it afloat. When it's on fire, there's nowhere to go. you don't have a lot of fire-fighting equipment on board a vessel. We almost bought it then, but, we survived. And like I say, you just remember the good times, not the bad times.
Yeah, it's easier to remember.
Yeah, it's easier. Been aground a couple times, several times in False Pass.
Who hasn't in False Pass, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Can you explain to our listeners what the experience is with False Pass?
Well, the first experience I had was going through there was I didn't realize the tide ran so hard. And there's a turn you make, and I made a turn, and I saw a boat up there, and looked like he was kind of laying over. I made the turn, and I figured out real fast why he was laying over. He'd got up against the bank, and the tide just pushed him over. Well, it pushed us over there, too, so we sat there. When the tide changed,
pushed it back out.
Pushed us, it freed us up, and away we went. That was my first experience.
So, yeah, but what is False Pass?
False Pass.
A lot of our listeners won't know.
It's between two islands on the peninsula. It's very shallow. It goes from the Gulf to the Bering Sea.
It's the first shortcut, right?
It's a shortcut from going around. It takes another, it probably takes 16 hours to go around, so everybody likes to cut through there. It's very shallow, but if you pick your time, you can get through it. Like I say, I've been aground there a couple times. I think everybody has, but everybody's still using it today. The Coast Guard marked it. It's a lot easier today than it was back then. Back then, we did mostly you kind of sighted something, over here, and you made a turn, and you had radar, but that was a little iffy, too. Now we have GPS, and it's fairly easy to go through. We have track lines. The channel does change, but once somebody goes through, they give you an idea, and you kind of pick your way through. But much safer now than it was then. Like I say, a GPS, it made a huge difference in our fisheries. It revolutionized it. We went from Loran A to Loran C, the Grenada War. That was about the time Loran C was coming in, and we were using it. And then the military, when they had that war, they started changing it, moving it around every 24 hours. And so we had trouble finding our crab gear. We had to go back to old dead reckoning days. But
can you explain what the Lowrance system did? For
what it did was basically it mapped out everything on the globe. And so it picks points, and then it references them, and it references them to you. So it's really accurate within a number of feet, just a few feet. Now the tide changes the buoys, and you know, if you're at a certain waypoint, we call them, your buoy may be off a ways one way or the other because of the tide, but it's very accurate. So we could run where we were doing point to point, or using Loran A or radar. It got us to the point where we could go right there. It would still use it today. There's nothing better. It's now interfaced with everything else, sonar, fathometers. Our electronics have, for a while, we were changing electronics about every 3 or 4 years because it was being revolutionized. And today, everything is interconnected. American fishermen are very receptive to technology, and given a chance, we could wipe out anything because of our electronics and equipment. Americans have very fine equipment. Most of them are pretty driven. So
you say wipe out anything, meaning targeting a species and cleaning it up?
We could target a species and clean it out.
Fortunately, we have
we have restrictions against us.
So, we don't have all you cowboys running around there anymore.
We're no different than anybody else. We're greedy to a certain extent. We don't know. We just don't know when to quit.
Do you see your family? You've mentioned your grandson's already fishing. Do you see the Lowenbergs to continue this legacy?
Well, I see them doing it for a while. I don't know if I think fishing is going to go the route of all natural resources. It'll be corporate. It'll be industrial. I know everybody fights that, but the major fisheries, unfortunately, are going to go that way, I'm afraid. Not any different than your local grocery store or other resources, logging. I grew up in the Northwest. Everybody logged or fished. Today, hardly anybody logs there now. I mean, it's very, very corporate. So. Mm-hmm. I see fishing going that way, especially the major ones. Crabbing, it's extremely expensive to fish, and we're becoming extremely competitive, and we harvest it in a short period of time. So I don't know how many years it'll take. I think some of the smaller fisheries will always be around, some of the salmon fisheries, halibut fisheries, but your trawl fisheries, your crab fisheries, they're probably not going to be here forever.
Mm-hmm. That's too bad.
It is too bad because it's afforded a lot of people a great living. It's a good way to harvest it. It provides a lot of jobs, a lot of opportunity for people, other businesses. But like I say, I think it's like almost all the natural resources that we have gone that way. And seafood in the ocean is a natural resource.
It is. So. Well, Louis, I really appreciate you taking the time to share. Is there anything else you'd like to share? Or any final thoughts?
Well, my final thoughts are anybody that's interested in fishing, I urge them to give it a try. It's worth the experience. I don't know how long lasting it would be, but it's been very good for my family and myself. I thank the Lord that had the opportunity, and I thank the people that mentored me. Without them, I wouldn't have made it. I didn't have the capital nor the experience. And I look back, and I've given a lot of guys, young guys, a chance. excuse me. I think about the old feller. I was 20 years old when he took a chance on me. you know, in today's age, not very many people are willing to do that. So I hope that people will follow in my footsteps do the same. Like I say, it's been a great opportunity.
Okay. Well, thanks for taking the time.
You bet.
And one last question. Would you change anything?
Would I change it? No, I wouldn't change anything I've ever done in my life. You know, I've enjoyed every minute of it. I've had ups, I've had downs, I've had good times, bad times, but no, it's all part of life.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, guys, we'll see you next time.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to Galley Stories. We hope you like what the net brought in. Please leave us a review on iTunes, whether you like it or not. We're not fishing for compliments. Look us up on Facebook and Twitter, too, and reach out to us at galleystories@gmail.com.